Okay. So one of the anticipations of your difficulties actually helped me with teaching, with thinking about Keats. So I'll start with generalizations and then we'll go pretty quickly to the poems. But what's problematic about Keats is not reading every stanza, but figuring out what the links are between the stanzas, right? And that actually, he opens a new mode that 20th century poets are going to mine, in a sense, which is this incompleteness of connection. So there's a kind of, the reader is forced to make imaginative leaps that aren't, that the grounds for them aren't quite demonstrable. You can sort of say where you're going, but there's no compulsion to make those leaps. I think that that comes from two features of Keats, all right, and that become part of the culture eventually. The first is his distrust of consecutive reasoning, right, or of the notion of any kind of disciplinary truth. So he just doesn't want to set it up as an argument because he doesn't trust argument. And therefore, he's forced, in a sense, to make the readers explore what powers of connection they have that aren't based on reason or narrative. Okay, it's actually a kind of interesting. It's almost a kind of spiritual possibility for exploring how one can make connections. And sort of, this is overstated, but live with their risk. Live with the fact that there is no guarantee of the connections. There's a kind of a whole story about humanity almost built in into the poem's refusal again to rely on certain instruments, all right? You see that? I mean, that's not hard, right? I mean, probably not true either, but it's not hard. The second feature that connects nicely, actually, is because Keats loves intensity of the moment, right? I mean, he's always absorbed by the moment. It's almost as if it were a kind of mini tragedy to have to make transitions, because why do you want to leave the moment? The moment is so satisfying. Well, you have to leave the moment because you have to sort of have an intellect. You have to sort of relate moments to one another. But I think he almost wants the effect that every stanza is so full, he hates to leave it. And it's also so full, how do you get to make a transition to the next stanza? So there's a kind of problem of transition built into Keats's whole worldview. Can you see that? I mean, he wants so absolutely to be in the present, so absolutely to flesh out the present, that gaps, any kind of gaps and transitions are both problematic and necessary. Now you'll see in the first two poems, at least, that we'll talk about, how he sort of manages the issue of transition, at least itself. But I think it's, at least when I was walking down the hill, I was really struck by this strange conjunction between a certain adventure in reading and a certain adventure psychologically for Keats, for negotiating intensity, okay? I mean, let's go to Autumn, which is probably, it may be the cleanest poem in the English language in the sense of every gesture being. And it's the last of his odes. Even if you wanted to read this one, I wouldn't let you. It's, again, why would Autumn be interesting to Keats as a kind of framework? Because it's both, in a sense, the maximum of desire, right? Everything is ripe, but also everything's going to die. So this connection between ripeness of desire and death, and getting one's mind around that, to sort of keep death as something internal to the fullness of desire rather than external, and therefore a denial of desire. I mean, that's what Keats wants to do in the poem, right? I mean, you can always treat death as, actually, I mean, I've had this, as you get old, you try to actually imagine yourself dealing with dying by, the Greeks had these stelae, grave stelae. And so they would just carve on the grave. Okay? And they often had somebody shaking hands, right, as they're leaving. And so one of the things you try to do is to imagine dying as a kind of exchange for living well, right, and not this kind of, you know, violent negation. So it becomes part of the condition of living well. And that's sort of where, how Keats is trying to imagine in this poem. Right? So it's 925 at the bottom. One can just go further, but the whole issue of transition is basic to Romanticism itself, in the sense that the more you cultivate intensity and enthusiasm as values, the more the waning of these things becomes disasters, right? And how do you come to terms with the fact that moments end? So the more you value moments, the more you have to negotiate ends. See, I mean, that's a kind of simple notion, but it's really true. Right? And even in Lamia, which is a kind of crazy poem in a way, but, you know, if there's going to be the fullness of desire between the man and what can entice him totally, then there's going to be have to be subject to the philosopher's gaze. And in the end of that poem, it's all about looking. It's not about desiring anymore. And that's the whole notion. The look is the opposite of desire in that poem, because it takes in whole instead of being in the middle. Right? So intensity is always in the middle. And that's why the look is a kind of problem, because the look frames that intensity. Okay. I told you the story, right, about the person looking in at me, right? Didn't I? Yeah, okay. I only like to repeat across classes, not in classes. Okay. Season of mists and mellow fruitfulness. Just the internal rhymes, right? It's just, notice, you know, it's sort of ridiculous to talk about these things. It's like, but season of mists and mellow fruitfulness. The E sound of season is blended by the soft E sound of mellow. Just the short I sound becomes fruitful. And then there's the internal rhyme. So it's just incredibly musically aware as a line. Close bosom friend of the maturing sun, conspiring with him how to load and bless with fruit the vines that round the thatch eaves run, to bend with apples the moss cottage trees and fill all fruit with ripeness to the core, to swell the gourd and plump the hazel shells with a sweet kernel, to set budding more and still more later flowers for the bees until they think warm days will never cease, for summer has o'erbrimmed their clammy cells. Right, so the job of this first poem is to get ripeness of sound, get ripeness of images, get ripeness of desire. It's even why you move from the fruit to the bees, because the bees become the consciousness of the fruit, right? I mean, so you're sort of adding the levels of ripeness. All right, now the second stanza has to negotiate this possibility of the ending, but it delays it, and so it sort of gives you a kind of human figure of autumn. And the question was why, but Who hath not seen thee oft amid thy store? Sometimes whoever seeks abroad may find thee sitting careless on a granary floor, thy hair soft lifted by the winnowing wind, or on a half-reaped furrow sound asleep, drowse with the fume of poppies, while thy hook spares the next swath and all its twined flowers. And sometimes, like a gleaner, thou dost keep steady thy laden head across a brook, or by a cypress with patient look, thou watchest the last oozings hours by hours. If you think about your own sort of internal sensibilities, and just the sounds, the last oozing hours by hours, this kind of hunger to take every drop, right? But why move to, rather than this kind of natural ripeness, move to this figure who watches the situation? I think it's a kind of figure for the poet's observation, and also a kind of figure for what might endure from this whole scene. It's only after he has the watching figure that the third stanza can begin to lament, right? Where are the songs of spring? Aye, where are they? Think not of them. Thou hast thy music too. While barred clouds move, while clouds bloom the soft dying day, and touch the stubble plains with rosy hue. Then, in a wailful choir, the small gnats mourn. Again, this great sound. Between the wailful is long and the gnats is short. The choir is short and the mourn is long. The small gnats mourn among the river sallows, borne aloft or sinking as the light wind lives or dies. And it's almost like the Pope poem, right? That the light wind becomes a light sound. And full-grown lambs loud bleat from the hilly bourne. Hedge crickets sing, and now, with trebles soft, the redbreast whistles from a garden croft, and gathering swallows twitter in the sky. Notice just the sounds and the movement here. Think that of that thou hast thy music too, wailful choir, then grown lambs loudly beat, crickets sing, redbreast whistles, and gathering swallows twitter in the sky. So there's a whole set of sounds. Why end with a twitter? How does that negotiate the issue of ripeness and of the dying of ripeness? Go ahead. Right. And how does that complete the... Okay. Go ahead. Well, I see that one twitter, but I think that... Actually, it's interesting that gathering, he doesn't use an adjective after wailful until gathering swallows. So the suggestion is that it's a constant sound. But it is, it's a kind of, the whole stanza is a diminishment towards the figure of watching in the second stanza. But now it's listening. And what's the difference between listening and watching? Well, watching is kind of a distance, whereas listening is a participating in the process. And it's as if, I think, why are the swallows gathering, by the way? Because they're going away, right? I mean, I think, I don't know the behavior of swallows somewhere, but I know the behavior of lyric poems, and so they have to be going away. So that... Their twitter is part of the change of the scene, but it's also included in the scene. So he can't quite share the goddess figure of the watching, but hearing becomes an instrument to accept the modulations of ripeness without lament, right? I mean, it becomes a kind of poem of plenitude, even when there's the Twitter. I mean, you know, you wouldn't, you might, like, get your friend to go, you know, to a scene where the lambs are bleeding and the light is changing, but you wouldn't go to have a Twitter, you know. But the Twittering kind of celebrates the whole process. Go ahead. Oh no. Anything? I mean. See, so, I mean, this is my problem. So I think that this is an intelligent reading of the poem. It's a kind of emotionally satisfying to me. And there's another poem by Spencer about this guy makes this long love appeal. And he just recognizes that the woman's just been a stone. And he just, you know, and he gives up. And that's kind of what I feel when I'm trying to teach the poems. And it's not. I'm attacking you, but gently. I'm twittering rather than bleeding. But the issue of how to get to the affect so that one feels that you're not just explaining something, but actually giving people resources to actually be moved. I guess that's the issue, but I don't know how to solve it. So, but I mean, this is almost the end of the poems, and Emily Dickinson just works, so it's not a problem. Whitman's a problem. But, okay, well, so we'll just plow on. But if anybody has any idea, I know you talk about it in class, but I know what one could do, but it's too hard. It would be fun though. Just make somebody read until everybody moved. It would be torture, but it would be wonderful. All right, let's go to Ode to Psyche, which, I mean, To Autumn is a quiet poem. It's about quietness in relation to ripeness. The Ode to Psyche is a very different poem, again, about negotiating intensity. But here, what happens, I think, is that the very lack of worshippers for Psyche gives the poet a task. That is, the poet can become not just the worshiper, but the altar as well. That is, the poem becomes the altar. And in the process of trying to imagine what it would be like to worship Psyche, he comes to a notion of poetry itself as the place where you let the warm love in. And I think that's a really great notion. You know, you imagine the poem as this altar, but it's all has to be constructed so that it's the place that love can come in. You can't make the love. That's what I'm talking about, I guess, right? But you can produce the place where the love can come in, and that becomes the role in the poem. And again, part of it's in Lamy, it's in The Fall of Hyperion, if you get to read that, which I should have assigned. Keats was fascinated by the whole 19th century experience. I mean, the 19th century really, I mean, the 18th century started to sort of deny that there was a kind of Christian God for most characters, actually, who were writing. And God became a kind of nice guy, but not this ominous figure. But the 19th century sort of discovered the gods, that everybody had gods. And so the whole sense of, it was no longer pagan and then replaced by Christian, but fascination by what a pagan god meant. And how does one relate to pagan gods or Indonesian gods. I mean, as the more traveling that got reported, the more religion became an anthropology rather than a theology. And so poets became fascinated by what the gods were, how close you could get to the gods, how far you had to come from the gods. And Keats, in the Ode to Psyche, really has this imagination, wow, I found a god that hasn't been used up, right? I mean, it's like, you know, shopping, and all of a sudden you never thought you'd find this thing. And God, you know, this is I can buy this, I can build it, and it's really this exploration of, by imagining worshiping the God, also imagining using the instrument of poetry to approximate being the god. All right, so it's a kind of tremendous release for this discovery, and the poem wants to have this sense: how close can I come to the god itself by my imagination, having found this god who hasn't yet inspired imaginations? Okay, I mean that's the motif of the poem. Go ahead. I think that's right, though I'm not sure it's explicit, but the whole sense of, Schopenhauer will make it explicit, and also the guy who Marx, predecessor of Marx, who was the predecessor of Marx as a materialist philosopher? Anyway, he makes the big case that men have discovered gods, therefore men have created gods. And theology is really anthropology in a deep sense. And you're right that Blake has that exact same spirit. But then, if humans have created God, how close can you come to live that creative moment? I mean, that's the fantasy. There's a German poet named Hölderlin, Hölderlin, who went mad, but he went mad thinking about becoming a god. Nietzsche also went mad thinking about becoming a god. But, like, it's as if once the gods become anthropology, the kind of the heaven is not a border between you and the god, but a kind of transitional point almost. So it's hard not to imagine that. The highest praise I've ever been given, like, two people in my life, but is, you know, that you made me feel like a god. He could wake up every morning and do it. I mean, that was pretty good. But all right. I wanted to see also how the movement goes in the poem, because the very fact again that she's the latest god also means that gods die, just as people die, and so he has to sort of come to terms with that as well. All right. O goddess, hear these tuneless numbers, rung by sweet enforcement and remembrance dear, and pardon that they secret should be sung, even into thine own soft, conscient ear. What's the figure there? A totally ambitious figure. He is going to tell the god's own secrets to inside her ear. He's going to actually occupy her ear and know her. Surely I dreamt today. Or did I see the winged Psyche with awakened eyes? And remember, Psyche always seeks love. But she finds that love in the form of Cupid will only come if she doesn't see at night. Right? So that's the kind of crucial thing. And it's an interesting allegory that Psyche, that is the mind, the imagination, is always wanting love. But when it tries to have it, when it doesn't have a kind of relaxation, willing to wait in the dark, it destroys the very thing it wants, right? I mean, so that's the figure of Psyche. Again, that's part of the attraction for Keats, that the myth itself has a relation to love that seems a more livable one than the figures of demand in any kind of way. It's just kind of waiting in the dark, right? Surely I dreamt today, or did I see the winged Psyche with awakened eyes? I wandered in a forest thoughtlessly, and on the sudden, fainting with surprise, saw two fair creatures couched side by side in deepest grass beneath the whispering roof of leaves and tremble blossoms, where there ran a brooklet scarce espied. Mid hushed cooled flowers, fragrant-eyed blue, silver-white and budded Tyrian, they lay calm breathing on the bedded grass. Their arms embraced, and their pinions too. Their lips touched not, but had not bad adieu. Why is this fascinating to him? Well, as if disjointed by soft-handed slumber, and ready still past kisses to outnumber, at tender-eyed dawn of Aurorian love, the winged boy I knew, but who wast thou? Oh, happy, happy dove, his Psyche true. Who was thou is not just her name. He obviously knows her name. But what is it that he can be loved, right? But the interesting thing, the Keatsian moment, is Their lips touch not, but the head not badges you. Why is that a Kissian moment? Okay. You mean it's all possibility and no demand. And that's it. Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. It hasn't reached the climax yet, but it could always be on the verge of climax. I mean, that's the fantasy. All right. Now, after this kind of almost narrative moment, then Keats takes a kind of more official look, right? And it turns out that from the official look, there's a kind of a negative perspective. O latest born and loveliest vision far of all Olympus' faded hierarchy, fairer than Phoebus's sapphire region star or Vesper's amorous glow warm in the sky, fairer than these, though temple hast thou none, nor altar heaped with flowers, nor virgin choir to make delicious moan upon the midnight hours. Keats can't have even negative string three negatives together without a gorgeous, kind of vision of desire, and then he goes back to the negatives again. Nor virgin choir to make delicious moan upon the midnight hours. No voice, no lute, no pipe, no incense sweet from chain-swung censer teeming, no shrine, no grove, no oracle, no heap of pale-mouthed prophet dreaming. What's the force of those negatives? I mean, in one sense, they become causes of sympathy, right? She's stuck without worship. But they're also causes of possibility. He can be all of those things. So the more negatives that are heaped, the more room there is for what a poet could do in fealty to this goddess. I mean, in a weird sense, this is sort of silly, but it's kind of true. But who's the true priest of Psyche, right? Freud. And now Psyche has sort of alters every psychoanalyst couch, right, is a kind of alter to Psyche in a weird kind of way. This is not as stupid as it might seem initially. I mean, she's the goddess whom we need, actually, in a way. Okay. O brightest, though too late for antique vows, too late for the fond believing liar. So it's all about what negativity offers. When holy were the haunted forest boughs, holy the air, the water, and the fire. Yet even in those days, so far retired from happy pieties, by lucent fans fluttering among the faint Olympians, I see and sing by my own eyes inspired. So let me be thy choir and make a moan upon the midnight hours. Thy voice, thy lute, thy pipe, thy incense sweet from censers teeming, thy shrine, thy grove, thy oracle, thy heap of pale-mouthed prophet dreaming. Now, why this is incredible, actually, is he doesn't just find a role, but he completely embraces the sensuality of the role, thy shrine, thy grove, thy oracle, thy heat of pale-mouthed prophet dreaming. And typically, most writers would begin with the concrete and become more abstract, right? But notice how Keats works. Thy shrine, thy grove, thy oracle, thy heat of fail-not prophet dreaming. What he really wants is the action rather than the meaning, in a sense. But why doesn't the poem end here? I mean, he's made this discovery. He's reversed the negations. Then it'd be, have a nice three-part structure. The goddess, what she lacks, what he fulfills. Why does he need another stanza? Again, these may seem silly questions, but they're ways of getting intimate with the poems. Because then the next stanza sort of grows out of a need rather than just a kind of arbitrary, you just have to read another one, right, another stanza. But if you can see it as a need, so why? What's lacking before the fourth stanza? That, yeah. Right, it's the actual commitment. Yeah, I think that's the main point. The third stanza is the recognition. The fourth stanza is the commitment. But also, what does he get by virtue of the commitment? He gets a sense of almost structure in the last stanza rather than just activity, right? I mean, in the third stanza, he's really excited about this possibility of becoming the heat of pale mouth prophet dreaming. In the fourth stanza, he's a builder. He's really a poet, right? Yet I will be thy priest and build a fane in some untrodden region of my mind where branched thoughts, new grown with pleasant pain, instead of pine, shall murmur in the wind. He's imagining now actually not just intensities but thoughts, structures, as part of the worship. Far, far around these shall dark-clustered trees fledge the wild ridge mountains steep by steep, and there, by zephyrs, streams, and birds and bees, the moss-laid dryads shall be lulled to sleep. And in the midst of this wide quietness, a rosy sanctuary will I dress with the wreathed trellis of a working brain, with buds and bells and stars without a name, with all the gardener fancy e'er could feign, who breeding flowers will never breed the same. And there shall be for thee all soft delight that shadowy thought can win, a bright torch and a casement ope at night to let the warm love in. I mean, again, this is a very sexual poem. It's about opening up to warm love. But how does he imagine it? Why does it matter that... that in effect, his brain and the altar become the same place, right? I mean, that's the key to the last stanza. It's a complete identification of the wreathed trellis of a working brain with not just the place of worship, right? But what is a temple? A temple is a place that the god visits, right? I mean, that is a temple draws the god in. So the brain as a temple also draws the god in. And how does it draw the god in? It draws the god in a kind of quietness. I mean, that's the third stanza, the end, by heat of pale mouth prophet dreaming. But that's all energy. Once he decides that he's really a builder as the form of worship, then there's a much more structural and enduring relation. So the quietness of the poem is also the confidence at the end of having a place that that both the god can visit, and then when the god visits, she will produce the darkness that the love can enter, that Amor can enter to complete psyche and to complete him. So it becomes, just in terms of a construct, the wreathed trellis of a working brain becomes the source of identification with the goddess. And because it's the goddess psyche, that identification promises a kind of darkness that the warm love can come in. So at the poet's intensity of fantasy in a certain way, that's the means also to let the world in as love. It's a really terrific figure of how the world completes the poem. It's completely solipsistic, and it says, I'm just going to identify with the goddess. But it's the goddess who lets the warm love in, right? And that's the kind of power of the identification. So it's as if one could reconstruct the possibility of a real Christian value, that is love, out of the multiplicity of gods that are released, and the power of the imagination to sort of capture those gods. All right. Any questions about, one of the problems is, I don't know, I didn't really state it. But no. All right. Well, let's go to... also to the Ode to the Nightingale, because that's, I don't understand the Ode to the Grecian Urn, so I'm always avoiding that. Well, let's do first the Ode on Melancholy. I will read it all. But what's interesting about it's almost as if the ode is a classical form of celebration of the topic, usually. Keats makes it a form of identification with the topic, right? All the four odes. And the identification with melancholy is very interesting, because what do you do with melancholy, right? That is kind of the sadness that comes from too much, right? You've been totally identified, and now you're, in a sense, dead to that event. Should melancholy be something that is a kind of negative state that is treated as a certain kind of failure of connection? Or, for Keats, again, can melancholy be a positive state because of one's awareness of loss and gain at the same time? I mean, that is a kind of melancholy is always going to come to someone who grabs for life, right? And so rather than lamenting the melancholy, try to produce as much of it as possible, because that's a kind of measure of the intensity of a life. And so it just, in the second stanza, and third stanza also, actually, in the beginning, but when the melancholy fit shall fall sudden from heaven like a weeping cloud that fosters the droop-headed flowers all, and hides the green hill in an April shroud, right? Melancholy's like a cloud in that sense, the classical view of melancholy. But now the Keatsian priest says, then glut thy sorrow on a morning rose, or on the rainbow of the salt sand wave, or on the wealth of globed peonies, and feed deep, deep upon her peerless eyes. Grab the very thing that is producing melancholy, because of this relation between intensity and beauty. So she dwells with beauty, that is melancholy. Beauty that must die, and joy, whose hand is ever at his lips, bidding adieu and aching pleasure nigh. So joy is the figure that always anticipates its own demise, but keeps pleasure near by that very fact of anticipation. I think that's how to read that line. I, in the very temple of delight, veiled melancholy has her sovereign shrine, though seen of none, save him whose strenuous tongue can burst joy's grape against his palate fine. His soul shall taste the sadness of her might and be among her cloudy trophies hung. He'll give up his being to that possibility of melancholy, because she's such a powerful goddess, because she certifies the fact that you've drained things to the dreg. Why is the contrast in the sounds here? Though seen of none, same him whose strenuous tongue can burst joy's grape against his palate fine. What's the distinctive feature of that line, can burst joy's grape against his palate fine? It's just, I mean, it's virtually monosyllabic, and it's the combination of the strenuous tongue, which is a mouthful, and then just the monosyllabic burst joy's grape against the simplicity of the absoluteness of that act is part of the motion of the poem. All right, let me do a little bit of the Nightingale. Because this is a poem about depression. It's really, again, the transitions are negotiating how to relate to this figure of the nightingale. Why? Because the nightingale is completely absorbed in its song, right? This is a total. It's as if the nightingale is only the song. It doesn't do anything but sing, right? So Keats begins with this contrast. My heart aches in a drowsy numbness, pains my senses, though I've hummed like I go, or emptied some dull opiate in the drain. He's got nothing. And he hears the nightingale. And the contrast from the nightingale could either make him depressed, that's one simple solution, or he could be fascinated, obsessed by the nightingale and the possibility of that version of happiness. So he chooses that route of identification rather than the route of depression in the poem. And so the whole second stanza is this rich, sensuous notion of where you could go with the nightingale. But he can't go, right? The figure, the poem just keeps moving back and forth. The more he identifies with the nightingale, what happens to his life? The more his life seems oppressive, right? So that's the third stanza. He's talking to the nightingale. Fade far away, dissolve and quite forget what thou among the leaves has never known. And then just the beat of these poems, the weariness, the fever, and the threat, here, where men sit and hear each other groan, all monosyllables, where palsy shakes a few sad last gray hairs, where youth grows pale and specter thin and dies. The total weight of self-consciousness after the with beaded bubbles winking at the brim and purple-stained mouth, right? I mean, total contrast in sounds and effects. So, again, Keats moved back to the nightingale, now on the notion that, well, I won't identify with you just existentially, but I'll use poetry to evade this ugliness and align with you, but in the very fantasy of leaving with the nightingale in the dark, he can't find anything to write poetry about. I mean, because that's the whole point of I cannot see what flowers are on my feet or what soft incense hangs about the bough. That is, the whole fantasy of escape means impoverishment, analogously to the other forms of impoverishment that are his life in the third stanza. So there's a kind of he relates to the darkness, but not to the poetry part. So in the sixth stanza, so the fourth and the fifth stanzas are this dream of escape and the fact that he can't see, so he's got to have another solution. That's the turning point of the poem. And then he has to negotiate the realization that what really turns him on about the nightingale is the same kind of absolute. For humans, the only parallel to the nightingale's continuous song is death. That is, it becomes one thing. And Keats loved death. That's why I think the movie Bright Star, which is at the Elmwood, Jane Campion is fascinated by death as well. And I think that's going to have to be an intense movie. Keats really thought about the kind of the ripeness of death, to be with everything, to not be tormented and not divided at all. And that's the kind of realization in this poem. But here, too, human death is not like the glorious sense of the nightingale's song. So he turns back to himself. And I just want to do the very ending for forlorn. The very word is like a bell to toll me back from thee to my soul self, to his own loneliness. Adieu. The fancy cannot cheat so well as she is famed to do, deceiving elf. Adieu, adieu, thy plaintive anthem fades past the near meadows, over the still stream, up the hillside, and now she's buried deep in the next valley glades. It's interesting, why does he get so slow about the song and as it fades? Because he's moving into a kind of human state of just sheer quiet attention. There's no Keatsian machinery here, right? There's just observation and a kind of quietness again. And it's very effective, just the names as the song moves. Then having this quietness, then there's a total form of self-reflection. Was it a vision or a waking dream? What is that music? Do I wake or sleep? And that's the interesting romantic question and the Keatsian question especially. Is the loss of the dream waking to reality or turning to sleep because you're waking to reality? Right? I mean, in other words, the poem turns to reality, but he can't see, and no one can see. That's part of the intensity of the source of poetry, whether to turn to reality is a waking up or a sleeping, because he was much more intense when he was trying to get to the bird than this resolution kind of in the poem. So the very distrust of reason and consecutive reasoning puts intensity in that situation. When you lose it, are you becoming a realist? Are you becoming a schmuck? Right? I mean, and you only know that there's specialness and there's reality, but it's very hard to kind of adjust to that situation. In other words, romanticism is perennial sort of youth in that sense, that always reality comes as a negative rather than as a positive, or at least the possibility of it. But that's the sort of adventure of Keats, exploring how much you lose when you can't trust to that imagining. All right. I wish I could say that you'll come to appreciate my words and wisdom as you get older. But you won't. But as you get older, I'll be dead and I won't care. So...